It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear about the brain drain from rural America, but what about the brain gain? We'll find out why lots of people have made the move to rural life since the 1970s, and more people may be doing it since the start of the pandemic. First, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is telling Foxconn it's time to renegotiate its contract with the state. That's after the company failed to create the minimum number of jobs last year to qualify for tax credits. Foxconn's plans for its Wisconsin project have changed repeatedly since 2017. It had originally pledged to make Generation 10.5 LCD display screens, then a less high-tech model. Last month, it received a permit to repurpose one of its main buildings from manufacturing to storage. Most of the nearly $3 billion in state incentives under the current contract are tied to job creation, but Foxconn has already received about $400 million in state and local support, including infrastructure work and buying nearby properties. The company says it remains committed to its promise of 13,000 jobs. In a statement, they cited several hundred million dollars of investment already made at its site in Racine County. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Foxconn project in Wisconsin? Have your feelings about it changed since the deal was announced 3 years ago? Do you want to see the state renegotiate its contract with the company? If you're from the area where it's being built, are you still hopeful that something is going to come out of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Willie Shea is a professor of management practice and business administration at Harvard Business School and co-author of the book Producing Prosperity, Why America Needs a Manufacturing Renaissance. Willie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We've talked to you about Foxconn on and off over the last few years. What's your reaction to this news now that the state is trying to renegotiate with Foxconn and that the state says Foxconn fell short on its targets, its job targets for a subsidy?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was never really surprised. I sort of anticipated this outcome at the very onset because, you know, the building a Gen 10.5 LCD factory, just the way the project got started, I've called it a state visit project. You know, when the big guys get together, they announce big thing, some big project, but then things change and they evolve. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing now.
Yeah, talk about what we've seen elsewhere in the world when there are these big Foxconn projects that may or may not amount to what was initially promised.
Well, first of all, we should talk about the LCD business. Okay, the LCD business is the business of making these flat screen televisions or your computer monitors. Okay, that's a notoriously cyclic business. Okay, and when Foxconn originally announced the intention to build this Gen 10.5 factory in Wisconsin. You know, at the time, I thought it was a terrible time to build a factory because there was so much capacity coming on around the world that, you know, there was going to be a glut and then prices were going to go down. So it was not a surprise to me that they started dragging their heels on this. In fact, Foxconn had another factory in Guangzhou, in Guangdong province in southern China, where they've really been trying to sell it, right? Because it was kind of not the right time to bring on that additional capacity. So you have the market situation in the product that these factories make, as well as, you know, when they launched this project in Wisconsin, they didn't really have the supporting network of suppliers who were going to come in and supply them with essential ingredients. So, you know, frankly, it was never going to happen. We see this type of pattern a lot, especially in Asia. You know, people will announce a big deal, and then they'll modify those plans as market conditions change.
Is that really so bad, though? Might we not get something out of it, even if it's not the original thing?
Well, I don't think that's so bad. I mean, what you really want, and this is the intent behind incentives, of course, is you really want, you know, a high-tech facility of some kind here that will generate a lot of local jobs, right? First in construction and building everything. But then, you know, you want a business that is viable, right, which can produce products that the market wants to buy. Okay, they can keep people employed. If you don't have a project that is set up to win that way it's not sustainable anyways. I don't think it's good for anybody. So in my view, kind of that renegotiation, A, it was inevitable, and B, it's just as well that, you know, it's like, okay, guys, let's now figure out what's a realistic thing we should be doing.
An article from The Verge just came out in the last couple of days on Foxconn in Wisconsin. You were quoted in it at one point. One thing that's contended by people who had worked at Foxconn and quoted by the reporter was that Foxconn had gone on a hiring spree in the last couple months of a year and then laid people off early the next year, supposedly to hit the subsidy targets. Is this something we've seen from Foxconn elsewhere? Is this something that is hard to control, I guess, in a deal between a state and a big business like Foxconn?
Well, I don't really have visibility to hiring for a specific subsidy target. But, you know, a company like Foxconn, who, for example, manufactures a lot of iPhones for Apple and a lot of other equipment for Apple, typically hires and lets go a lot of people at any given time, right? They probably have hired a lot of people right now because they're ramping up production of iPhone 12s and they need to meet that surge of initial demand. Back a couple years ago when they were having trouble ramping up production of iPhone 10s, they went out and hired hundreds of thousands of people just to do rework, okay? So it's not unusual for companies like Foxconn or Chinese companies in general, or companies that operate in China, to kind of expand and contract as their needs go up and down. Whether, you know, you can, I can't trace to, you know, specifically I'm trying to hire to meet subsidies. You know, in general, though, these companies do hire and lay off based on how much work they have.
Talking about Foxconn in Wisconsin, Willie Shih is with us from Harvard Business School. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Wisconsin, the state government says Foxconn didn't meet their hiring targets for 2019 that they needed for state subsidies. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Chris?
Just my... There's a couple of different things. When I was a younger man getting into the workforce, I was really excited to hear about Foxconn's plans to develop so many needed jobs in Wisconsin. But now as time passes by, it's becoming to look less and less like it. And the benefits that have been reaped by this company at this location with the empty shells of a building is frustrating, and I feel that something needs to get owed back to the citizens. I was really excited to hopefully work for Foxconn, but, you know, as everything changes, so I had to change my lifestyle, and now I'm employed.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Willie, do you think that the jobs that Chris was hoping for a few years ago will still emerge?
Well, that would be my hope. I'm very sympathetic to people like Chris. I'm very sympathetic to Wisconsin taxpayers who put up a lot of money, you know, in the hopes of creating these jobs. You know, I think the challenge is this is a volatile industry, kind of. The bid to build a Gen 10.5 LCD factory, that would have brought a lot of high-tech jobs. It would require a lot of training and so on. Maybe that was, I don't know, hindsight is always 20/20. Maybe that was kind of too big a bite to take, considering the risks that came with it, that maybe this factory would never be built. Okay. Now, Foxconn does a lot of other types of stuff, which, you know, maybe they could assemble medical equipment, maybe they could assemble TV sets, maybe they could assemble other things, right? I mean, I would hope that that would be the discussion now. And I would urge people who are negotiating with them to think about how do we get something that's sustainable? In other words, an operation that creates jobs that will be maybe a little less cyclical than what we're seeing with the flat panel display industry.
We're talking to Willie Shi right now, professor of management practice and business administration at Harvard Business School, looking at the Foxconn project in Wisconsin after the state says wants to negotiate its contract, renegotiate it after the company the state says didn't hit job targets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's time to make changes to the state's deal with Foxconn? Have your feelings about the project changed since the beginning? What are your hopes for it? What would you suggest the state do in the midst of renegotiating this deal? Call 800-642-1234. If you have worked for Foxconn or tried to negotiate a supply deal with them, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Willie Shi, professor of management practice and business administration at Harvard Business School, looking at the Foxconn project in Racine County after the company missed its hiring targets last year for subsidies, according to the state. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I've always been wondering, since the deal was made, about the technology of LED panels. The newest generation of the Apple phones are using a different type of technology for their display. It's called organic LEDs. It is a different technology, and that's the trend, I believe, for most panel makers, at least the high-end stuff. So I'm wondering, does that have any bearing on the situation?
Tom, OLEDs are an emissive technology, right? So they have a lot of advantages. They are considered a little more advanced than your standard LCD flat panels. So, for example, the leaders in manufacturing those right now are Samsung and LG of Korea, okay? And there are some Chinese manufacturers who are investing heavily to make those, okay? And, of course, Japanese manufacturers are still in the lead on that. I would say that's a little bit harder. You have to have a little more science and technology background in order to make those. Foxconn has not historically made those yet. Okay, so it's a little out of reach for them right now.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Louise now in Dodgeville. Louise, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what your guest thought about just the environmental impact that Foxconn, by building it, created, and then a lot of people were displaced from their homes because of the big footprint of the Foxconn development. So if they aren't able to kind of fulfill what they intentionally tried to create, how should the state address Foxconn for those impacts that were created? And Louise, I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling in, Louise. Willie, any thoughts for Louise?
Well, I've actually talked to some people who are in that area who've been impacted, including the last homeowner. And, you know, they cleared a lot of land. They put in a lot of other infrastructure. You know, the question for the state right now is, can we get that kind of industrial development in this area where they've laid in that infrastructure? Otherwise, then what are you going to do? If you can't do it, then is there some remediation in plan? But, you know, they've built roads, they've plowed up a lot of farmland and homes and everything. So it's a big problem, right? But, you know, if not Foxconn, can you bring something else in?
Thanks a lot for that call, Louise, at 800-642-1234. Andrew joins us next in Menominee. Andrew, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that the deal definitely needs to be renegotiated, that $3 billion is far too much of a tax break. They've talked about how long it's going to take to actually break even on that deal. And then there's the reports of them renting like buildings in downtown Milwaukee for office space, and there's practically nobody there. They haven't hit the goals for hiring people. There's been reports of other factories where the same thing has happened, where they've pulled the same tricks, and they've shown what sort of manufacturer and business partner they are. So I think the deal needs to be renegotiated to reflect that.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. Willie, you've talked some about what you would suggest the state do in trying to renegotiate a deal. The $3 billion Andrew mentioned, a lot of that, of course, conditional on those job numbers. So is Wisconsin really losing that much? They don't hit the job numbers. They don't get the subsidies.
Well, you know, I think what we're seeing reflects, renting buildings in Milwaukee and then not filling them. All these things kind of reflect a situation of them trying to struggling to kind of hold on to the subsidies and figuring out a plan. To me, it shows that they don't really have a good plan on how they're going to get out of this fix that they've gotten into. That's a problem right now. But Foxconn is a large company. Okay. And so my advice to the state is like, help them figure out what they're going to put here, but focus on something that's going to be sustainable, right? Something that's going to be maybe a little less cyclical, something, you know, America is a very large market for a lot of the stuff they produce. So what can I produce here that will be sustainable, that will create those jobs, you know, that will use all this space that we and infrastructure that we've developed? It's not going to be an LCD fab, but it could be something else.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Willie Shih from Harvard Business School about the latest on the Foxconn deal here in Wisconsin. Willie, big screens, small screens. There's been talk of a smart cities project with Racine. Supplying government supplies was on the table at one point. According to this Verge piece, fish farming came up. Do we know if the Foxconn plant has actually made anything at this point?
I don't know. Occasionally people send me documents from the Planning Commission and stuff, and I look at it and it's like, wow, this looks like it could be that. Okay, but you know, you can judge it by, is there a lot of truck traffic bringing parts and parts in and finished goods out? So my guess is probably not. You know, to me, it's what it's indicating is they're struggling to figure something out, right? And they probably need some help figuring that out.
Let's go back to our callers. Ted is on the line in Racine. Ted, hello. Oop. I think we lost Ted. Yes. Okay. Thanks, though, for trying to call in at 800-642-1234. Ted did want to ask some about the politics of this, the big plans announced in an election year for governor here. President Trump involved, still talking about Foxconn some as recently as this last week at a rally. Can you talk about the political side of things, Willie?
Well, yeah, you know, it's all about creating jobs, right, and stable jobs, right? So, I mean, there's always going to be that kind of positioning, you know, prior to an election. This is a tough time to be doing that, though, because, you know, it's a tough economy. There's a lot of uncertainty about how long the COVID-19 pandemic is going to last. All right. So, you know, it's a tough situation. You know, I feel bad for the people in southeastern Wisconsin. Right. But, you know, we're going to need a lot of things to get better before we see a lot of progress on this, I think.
Let's try another caller now. Carol is with us in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if there's any way to hold the people who got us into this mess responsible, such as the ex-governor or the Republicans who are promoting this. And any person on the street almost could have seen in those days when they were bringing this in that Foxconn had a very bad reputation. They had done some terrible thing, and it was common knowledge. We all knew about it. But yet they pushed that in, and now all this expense. And is Wisconsin here to be abused by companies that want to come in and abuse us? Is that why we're here? Or
Carol,
do we have any, you know, rights?
Carol, thanks a lot for the call. Is Carol right that maybe people could have looked at what Foxconn had done elsewhere and seen this coming, Willie?
Well, when I was a kid growing up in Milwaukee, in southeastern Wisconsin, and Chicago as well, you know, my parents used to talk about, you know, people whose eyes were bigger than their stomach. Okay. And as I reflect on this situation, what happened is some of the leadership of the state were shown a Gen 10.5 factory in Asia. Okay. And it's like, oh, wow, that would be great to have something like that in Wisconsin. Okay. But, and they pushed that, and Foxconn went along with that in exchange for the subsidies, not really thinking about the economics of how am I going to make this work. Early on when this happened, I said, you know, $4 billion of subsidies, I think, was promised at the time. Okay, if you're going to build a Gen 10.5 factory anywhere in the world, since everyone in Asia is subsidized, I said $4 billion in subsidies isn't going to be enough. And on top of that, you have to subsidize the suppliers. And since the state didn't subsidize all the suppliers because, you know, they didn't go all in on this, then the critical suppliers didn't move in. And at that point, it was obvious that there was no way this factory was going to ever get built, right? So, you know, there was this grand vision, but like my parents used to say, maybe the eyes were bigger than the stomach.
Willie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Willie Shee is a professor of management practice and business administration at Harvard Business School and co-author of the book Producing Prosperity, Why America Needs a Manufacturing Renaissance. He talked to us about where the Foxconn project goes after the state said last week that the company had fallen short of its 2019 hiring goals. While it's too early to have any concrete data, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that suggests that pandemic living has some people in cities considering a move to a small town or more rural area. And even if we're not actually moving, more people are looking at rural listings on realty sites. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you moved to a more rural area or thought about it? Especially if you're in a city, moving to a smaller town or rural area, what is motivating that thinking? What do you like about living where you currently live, whether it's a city or in the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan Kittinger is the broker owner of United Country Oakwood Realty LLC in Viroqua. They also serve the counties of Crawford, Richland, and Monroe. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, have you seen any uptick in interest in a rural home since the pandemic started?
We have. And I don't know if it's strictly the pandemic or if it's good interest rates, but there certainly is an incredible market right now and people looking to buy some of these country properties.
And what do people talk about when they're looking at living the country? I guess whether they're looking to move from a city or elsewhere in the country, what do they say about the things they like about living in that part of the state of the country?
You know, around here, you know, they like the lifestyle, the organic food. They like the trout streams, the biking opportunities, recreational, outdoor recreation. That's a big part of it, being able to be outdoors. Having some room, some acreage, growing their own food at times is something that they've expressed a desire to do and be a little more self-sufficient.
And we got a lot of comments on our Ideas Network Facebook page about this. A lot of people singing the praises of rural living. Some people with an asterisk, they're worried about the internet and that kind of technological communication. Is that a question you get a lot from people?
Oh, oftentimes people want to know what the internet speed is and if there's fiber optic. And, you know, we're fortunate around here because we have Vernon Communications, which has won awards for their high-speed internet. We have fiber optic ran out to these country properties. Many of them have fiber optic. And people from Milwaukee will come sometimes and say, I can't believe it. Your internet's better than ours. So we're fortunate. And that really, I think if there is something we've noticed from during the pandemic, it's that people now have the opportunity to live where they want to live and work from home. And so it's like they're able to choose now their lifestyle, choose where they want to be as opposed to choose where they need to work. So we are seeing that.
And before we let you go, Dan, what's the supply situation like? If people want to go buy houses in your neck of the woods, are there enough houses up for grabs?
I tell you, it's tough right now. They go fast. They go fast. Most of our listings have offers on them, and you'll see multiple offers at times. So even on these country properties, I know it's really hot in the cities, but even in these country properties, it's not easy for buyers because there's competition. So it's a good market for sellers, and the opportunities are there for buyers, but they need to, be looking, and they need to be prepared to, make a move kind of quickly if there's a certain property they really want.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us with your firsthand perspective on this.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Dan Kittinger is the broker owner of United Country Oakwood Realty LLC, located in Viroqua. They serve the counties of Crawford, Richland, and Monroe. Our next guest is a rural sociologist who's been following these trends of where people choose to live and what's going on in rural communities. Benjamin Winchester is a research fellow at the Center for Community Vitality at the University of Minnesota Extension. Ben has worked in four small towns across the Midwest since 1997. He conducts research on topics on community vitality, like his current work on a rural brain gain. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob.
We hear a lot in Wisconsin and elsewhere sometimes about rural communities having trouble keeping people at home and losing the youth to bigger cities, things like that. But you've seen a lot of trend in another way. What are you seeing?
Right, that's right. I think I do a lot of work around what I call the rural narrative. And a lot of times the narrative we use to describe our small towns and rural places really isn't all that good. A lot of times it's based upon what we had in years gone by or what we wish we had or could have had. And really, we rarely look around at what we've got. And part of what we lament about is, the high school kids that when they graduate, they take off. And apparently this is a huge problem. I would argue that, there are actually people moving back. And we've done some research here for the past 20 years documenting what I call the brain gain. And that is people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s have been interested in moving to our rural communities really since the 70s. And when we started to publish on some of this and document some of these trends in, 2002, people are like, oh, this is new. We're like, well, it's actually not new. This trend of people moving to rural places overall has been happening since the 70s. They move for a variety of reasons, and we've conducted thousands of focus groups and surveys and found that, the primary reasons that we find that people move to our small towns is not just a job. While they may need to get a job, they move for three quality of life reasons. And number one is a slower pace of life. I think Dan mentioned some of that, access to open spaces and recreation and biking and trout fishing. So this slower pace of life that people have. And the second top reason is safety and security. And, many of the trends that we've got today in our urban centers, as well as some of the trends that we had seen in the 70s, led people to look outward toward our more rural places to move. And, finding a safe place to live is very high, especially with people with children. And the third cost, reason that people chose to move to our small towns was the low cost of housing. And really, it kind of surprised us that, we tend to view community development through an economic development lens. Like, we need to offer jobs and that'll bring people here. And while that may be true 100 years ago, we're quite obviously now in the middle of this pandemic in a very different world. And we're realizing quite blatantly that people don't always have to live where they work. In fact, they've been decoupling themselves from one another. And, even for the past 40 years, people don't always move to where they work. I lived in the small town of Hancock, 700 people, and I commuted to Morris every day. And we also saw people commute in all sorts of directions. So really this, this life that we've got in rural communities is very regional. Where we put our home isn't always where we find our job. But we live really what I call in the middle of everywhere. We put our house in the middle of all these opportunities of where we work, shop, play, and recreate.
I talked to a demographer here in Wisconsin a while back, and the word rural can obscure a lot of differences. There could be really what people think of as middle of nowhere, or maybe a rural belt an hour or half hour outside of an urban center that people go to for the best of both worlds. Do you see any subset of the rural Midwest in particular really seeing people moving into it?
Yeah, no, initially we kind of speculated, too, that, you know, maybe it was the prairie. The prairie wasn't going to exhibit this kind of growth, but people want to live in the prairie, too. Like, basically, the message that we like to tell is that your rural is not everybody's rural. Like, there are some people who want to live on the prairie. And of course, you've got the highly popular recreational areas and the trout streams, but really, you know, I think the biggest limiting factor in terms of trying to document our success has been population growth. And we tend to use, you know, population growth as our indicator for success or failure. And, you know, if our population goes up, we're a big winner. And if it goes down, we're a big loser. But if you even, you know, across the Northlands there in Wisconsin, you've got a number of counties up there like Iron County. They lost, like, say, 14% of their population. But the number of housing units went up by 5%. And, you know, and really the story for us is we've got a lot of homes right now that are occupied by our seniors. And they are staying in their homes longer than any other previous generation of their age. And that actually inhibits the ability for people to move into our towns when there's honestly nowhere for them to live. So until some of these housing stocks open up, I think it's very difficult for us to grow our populations. But really our story here is that we have seen growth in this brain gain across the country in 98% of all counties. No county is immune to having people want to live there.
Brianna, caller at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Green Bay. Dan, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Dan?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about just the concept of urban spread, which, you know, I think people have to be a little bit aware of that when they do move out into the country, that country can quickly become a subdivision. So, I mean, I live near Denmark, and we've seen, for good, bad, or otherwise, you know, these at one point you think you're living a little bit out of town, and then subdivision after subdivision shows up, and now you're living more of a suburb of Green Bay than you really are, you know, more out in the woods, I mean, or out in prairie land. So just something to think about and see how that lies within people's mindsets. And then
Dan,
just
thanks a lot for the call. What's the Yogi Berra quote? Nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. Ben, do we see that? People move to the country and maybe the suburbs or urban sprawl follows them there?
Oh, you bet. I mean, really, when you look at the growth of many of the urban centers across this country, it's not that urban areas have grown taller. They've grown wider. And why have they grown wider? Because once people hit their 30s, they don't want to live in the core metro. I mean, not everybody. Not everybody does. And so they move out. It is the reason why we have the whole first ring suburbs. And then, you know, that were created in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And then as so many people moved out, they became urbanized. And then when the folks in the 60s, 70s, and 80s were in the core urban areas, and they were like, I don't want to live here anymore. I'm going to look out. And then all of a sudden they look out. And what Dan mentioned, those first ring suburbs are now urbanized. And that led to the growth of the second ring suburbs. I mean, in Wisconsin, 12 counties have been reclassified from rural to urban since 1974, which are now home to over 900,000 people. So in many ways, some of our rural areas are so popular, they become urbanized and become places that we barely recognize. So it's definitely a trend that's been happening across this country. 25% of all rural counties in this country have been reclassified from rural to urban. And for me, that tells the story of rural preference. There are people choosing to move into these rural environments. And again, some of these places have been transformed so greatly, especially on the urban fringe, that they become these urban centers that people essentially first moved out to get away from.
Talking to Benjamin Winchester, research fellow at the Center for Community Vitality at the University of Minnesota Extension. He's a rural sociologist. We're looking at rural life and what's motivating some people in cities to move to small towns or rural areas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you moved in that direction, big city to small town or rural area, or the other way around? What do you prefer about one way of life or another, or do you see trade-offs either way? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk with rural sociologist Benjamin Winchester, research fellow at the Center for Community Vitality at the University of Minnesota Extension, talking about why some people over the last few decades have been looking to move to rural areas from urban areas. Anecdotally, it sounds like that may be happening some more during the pandemic, though the research is far from conclusive or done on that yet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Let's go to another caller now. Dan is with us in Madison. Dan, hi.
Hello. due to the COVID, like I come from a bigger city, moved to Wisconsin for because my wife grew up here and live out just inside Madison. And due to the pandemic, it's teaching me that I could pretty much live anywhere because my life is not much that much different. So I'm really open to moving to rural when I used to be only a city guy.
And Dan, are you working from home? Is that part of why you're thinking you could be anywhere now?
Yeah, that's a big part is not having to go to an office every day and having my like work style change and my lifestyle change has really made it more appealing to live in a smaller town. One for cost is a huge thing.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. A couple interesting things there, Ben. One is, yeah, and we were talking about this some, if you can do your work anywhere, why not live wherever you want? I know it's too soon to tell during the pandemic, but do you think this is going to accelerate what you're seeing with people in our caller's position who do take up rural life because they can work from there?
Right, yeah. No, we've got, I think, a vast renewed interest in living rural today. And I think people are actually realizing that you can be in a rural community and be successful. I think, you know, my dominant work is around how negative the rural narrative is and that you would think all of our places were dying according to the broader narrative. But when you get to these communities, you see that we actually have places that look, while they look different, they're certainly not dead. You know, and again, if all our small towns are dying, then why can't I find a house to buy? I mean, I think it's very difficult for people looking to move into small towns right now. Again, our inhibiting factor is we have a lot of family homes, and we had a normal just, you know, 6-7 months ago, which was a very tight labor market and a housing workforce housing shortage. We are not far removed from that. We still have the housing shortage. Only right now, we do have a network of realtors that we've been gathering information from here in Minnesota. And while you're right, there isn't well-established research on these trends of out-migration from urban to rural. But we do know and are ticking some of these from our realtor studies that there is a renewed interest. Homes are going very quickly. People are interested in moving to rural environments and are finding out that they can actually be quite successful in their rural communities.
On the other hand, Dan also mentioned housing costs. Housing costs are really high in popular cities because so many people want to live there that it's driving out a lot of the people who could have lived here, and it spills from, you know, one city to another. There's still, this is not a mass exodus from our urban areas to our rural areas, is it?
No, that's right. You know, many of our places are doing just fine in terms of people not wanting to move out, but I think especially we had seen some headlines come out from New York that, you know, there was a newspaper article that quoted 400,000 people have left New York City since the pandemic had started and moved to, you know, upstate New York and through Maine and places like that. And so, you know, we're really lucky right now to have, we're going to have census data come out here, and we're going to be able to better understand some of these trends and their impacts on this rural community. But without some solid research, I think it's hard for our communities to really establish what they can do. You know, what's realistic? What's something that we have control over here? Where you've got the market on one side really kind of driving up prices, driving demand. Is there anything we can do locally to help build supply? When on the supply side of things, we know that, you know, housing construction costs are through the roof. Just for, you know, materials alone, lumber is three times the cost it was a year ago. So I think when we look to our small towns, one of the things that we've got is a housing stock that's occupied anywhere between 30 to 40% of our rural homeowners are over the age of 70. And they're not going to be in their homes forever. And we want to let these folks know that there are actually people that want to live in their homes. So then it's up to our local communities to better establish, are there move-over housing opportunities for our seniors? Because when we open up some of the housing that our seniors are in, that's workforce housing. So I think as we move forward, we need to better understand the moving in, moving out, and moving over model of housing in each community.
Talking to Benjamin Winchester, rural sociologist, about interest in moving to rural America. It's been going on for a long time, decades, he says. The COVID pandemic may be accelerating it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, we got a lot of comments on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Here are a few with a common theme. Linda says, this is happening here in northern Minnesota. I think they will get tired of our slow internet unless they help us get better access. Kathy says, we moved to rural area and the internet is miserable, but the quiet and solitude is worth it. Roberta says, even in villages near large cities, the internet is slow. A friend just moved 3 miles out of a larger city and can't work from home even during the pandemic. Can you talk some, Ben, about the internet factor in all this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, definitely. There are jobs that cannot be done without the internet. And but we can't paint broadband with a broad brush either. As Realtor Dan had mentioned, and another caller had mentioned, like, broadband is available in our rural communities. While it's not available everywhere, I think the loudest voices need to be out there and saying that they don't have it right now. But at the same time, here in Minnesota and Wisconsin, we've got a strong network of fiber across. I mean, I'm looking at a Wisconsin broadband office map right now that, you know, it's not as if the cities have the broadband and all of the rural areas do not. In fact, many of our rural communities have co-ops. And we've got this across the nation. And co-ops have invested in broadband and fiber a decade ago in many of our rural communities. When I lived in the small town of Hancock and we moved to St. Cloud, Minnesota, which is an urban area, our internet speeds were a quarter of what I had available to me in the small town of Hancock. So I think you do your homework these days. And I think we do have more savvy consumers. When in many ways in the past, people would just assume you'd have some level of broadband. But now when people are actually looking and asking, like, well, I guess 10 meg down really isn't broadband. So I need to set some parameters in terms of what broadband actually means and what those speeds denote.
In our last minute and a half or so, how important is it for those areas that don't have it and want to have some of the kind of economic development and move-in that you're looking for to get that problem solved?
Yeah, I think there's we have seen a variety of different strategies. Sometimes local co-ops do it all themselves and did do it. They laid fiber to the farm in some places. But we've also got state incentives too, but I see it as a public utility in many ways. This is a public service. Like, this is a core infrastructure piece for not just our consumers, because when you've got a high download speed, that means you're consuming content. But we also need to ensure that we have an upload speed. Because if we cannot have a decent size upstream for our rural communities, we won't be able to actually produce anything in the new economy. So unless we advocate for a stronger upstream, we're going to be a permanent class of consumers. So as we move forward, I would advocate for a comprehensive view of looking at trying to develop broadband for each and every community across this country.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Benjamin Winchester is a research fellow at the Center for Community Vitality at the University of Minnesota Extension. Ben's worked in four small towns across the Midwest since 1997. He also conducts research on topics relevant to community vitality, like his current work documenting a rural brain gain. You can still share your observations and maybe your own moves over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Gene writes, we have a cabin on a lake in northern Wisconsin by Minocqua, and the internet works perfectly. Cabins that go up for sale are snatched up in short order, and people are paying over asking price. Gene says, I was told by a couple of realtors that many of the buyers are city dwellers looking for an escape from the density and challenges of urban settings. It's pretty darn nice, Gene says, to be safe, have internet, lots of hiking trails, lake views, and peace. Well, let us know what you think. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page.